Please be advised, all music tracks used in this production are sole property of Kelsun Communications and are original compositions. Thank you.
Hey, it's Skiri Jones, executive producer of Elvis Duran and the Morning Show on Z100. I want to talk to you all about my friend and fellow Brooklyn College alumnus, Silas. Your e-journalist, social work advocate, Silas hosts and produces the award-winning Kelsun On The Air social work podcast. My friend and fellow BCR alum is now known nationally and internationally as Silas, your e-journalist, social work advocate. His podcast, it's also listed as one of the top social work podcasts you must follow, the award-winning Kelsun On The Air social work podcast.
Hello and welcome to all our listeners and viewers. This is Silas, your e-journalism social work advocate, producer and host of the award-winning Kelsun On The Air social work podcast, available wherever you get your podcast. Our podcast is rated internationally as one of the 40 best social work podcasts you must follow. This podcast promotes, celebrates, uplifts, and highlights the social work profession. Our aim is to educate the general public about the powerful impact social workers have on the lives of those they serve. The podcast will also amplify the vital contributions professional social workers make in every aspect of our society every day. Hello, everyone, and welcome. This is Silas, your e-journalism social work advocate, host of the award-winning Kelsun On The Air social work podcast. I'd like to invite you all to listen and enjoy a very special African-American History Month flashback. I'm going to take you back to the year 1993. At the time, I was a student at Suffolk Community College, and I was majoring in broadcast telecommunications. I had wound up getting a part-time job as a board operator at a small station out east in Hampton Bays, and the call letters were WWHB, and the dial position was 107.1. It was a local community radio station, but we were simulcasting on the east end a very powerful Manhattan radio station signal, WNEW, and the dial position was 102.7. Now, because we were simulcasting a signal from the city, when it came to public affairs programming and PSAs, according to FCC regulations, we were required to produce programming and highlight initiatives, organizations, and individuals that serve the East End. While being a part-time board operator, I was given an opportunity to be the East End College Campus Coordinator. And I used to produce what's known as the campus calendar. And what that entailed was just me reaching out to all the colleges on the East End. That would be Suffolk Community College, where I was attending, Stony Brook University, and LIU Southampton. And what I would do is I would find out what kinds of community events and activities they were having, and I would reach out to them, get their information, and I would create PSAs, and we would play it on the radio. While working as a part-time board operator, I had a great opportunity to be the only part-timer that was given an opportunity to be a public affairs producer and host. And so, because I was already doing research on activities and events and getting that information from the colleges, what came across my desk one day was an announcement that said there was a gentleman, Dr. Arthur A. Fletcher. He was going to be speaking at Stony Brook University as part of their Distinguished Lecturer Series in honor of Black History Month. So this was February of 1993. And when I saw that, the thought came to my mind, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if I could land an interview with Dr. Fletcher? And so I put on my producer hat. I made some calls. I got in touch with the university. They put me in touch with his public relations personnel. And I explained to them who I was, where I worked, and what I wanted to do. They spoke to Dr. Fletcher, and Dr. Fletcher said yes, he would be willing to be interviewed for the public affairs program, and it was named Where You Live. The issue was, at the time, Dr. Fletcher, he was having a problem, and his mobility wasn't as good as it could have been, and so They said you can do the interview. However, he can't come to the radio station. You have to come to him. And at the time, he was staying at the Three Village Inn in Stony Brook. And I said, no problem. I'll be there. And so I packed up my cassette player, microphones, cables, and I went down to the Three Village Inn and I met Dr. Arthur Fletcher. And you might say, okay, so that's great. You got an interview with Dr. Arthur Fletcher. But the thing that I haven't told you as of yet is at the time, he was the chairman of the United States Civil Rights Commission. And so I thought this was an amazing accomplishment to land an interview of that caliber. And so I was ecstatic. And upon meeting him, he was very warm and congenial. And we set up in his room and I had my microphones and my boom stands and I patched right into my cassette player and we sat there in his hotel room and I interviewed him. And so that's what you're going to hear coming up. But what's more interesting than all of that, not only was he the chairman of the United States Civil Rights Commission, he was also known and was widely known as the father of affirmative action. That's right. The late Dr. Arthur A. Fletcher was the one that invented affirmative action. However, at the time when it came into existence, it wasn't even called affirmative action. It was called the Philadelphia Plan. And then it was adopted by the United States federal government as something that then they began to call affirmative action. But it originally started with Dr. Fletcher, and he is widely known as the father of affirmative action. He also talks a little bit about how he fought discrimination and racism as early as in high school, and he also talked about being a product of the Buffalo Soldiers. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I invite you to sit back, listen, and enjoy this Black History Month flashback special from 1993 as I got the opportunity of a lifetime to interview the late Dr. Arthur A. Fletcher, the father of affirmative action and a product of the Buffalo Soldiers, just prior to him giving a keynote speech for Black History Month at Stony Brook University on Long Island in New York. Listen, enjoy, and be informed. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome to this segment of the show. This is Where You Live, and my guest for today is Mr. Arthur Fletcher, the chairman of the United States Civil Rights Commission. And this program is in the continuing efforts of WWHB's public affairs programming in honor of Black History Month. And we'd like to thank you, Mr. Fletcher, for taking time out of your busy schedule to sit and chat with us on this Where You Live. So welcome and thank you kindly.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have a chance to chat with young men like yourself who are bringing to life again the great struggle that's been going on in terms of slowly but surely, at a snail's pace, beginning to realize full equality in this nation's society and civilization. So pleasure to be here.
Okay, all right. Thank you kindly, and we'll be getting into depth on those issues that you mentioned a little later on in the interview. But for right now, Mr. Fletcher, could you tell us about your background and education?
Oh, background-wise, I'm the product of the famous Buffalo Soldiers, whose history is now beginning to surface. My daddy was in the 9th and 10th Cavalry, and I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, and I often tell people I was raised on the run. Because my father was moved around like military people are from base to base, education-wise, I'd gone to school in about 7 different states and 9 or 10 different elementary schools before I got to the 8th grade. And when I got there, I was so far behind in everything that my parents finally had to settle down and leave me at Junction City, Kansas, where Fort Riley is located, so that I could get caught up. I was in the 8th grade at the time, so I could get caught up and graduated on time, not necessarily with my class, because I had several different classes. I went to school in Oklahoma, went to school in California, Arizona, Kansas, and all those different places. But they settled me down at least in 1938, and I finished junior high school and high school in Junction City, Kansas, which is 4 miles from Fort Riley, Kansas. And that's where the 9th and 10th Cavalry was located at the time World War II got underway. I finished high school in May the 23rd, 1943. And I might add that my first protest on the civil rights issue had to do with the yearbook at Junction City Junior Senior High School. There had been a pattern up until 1943 of putting all black high school graduates, incidentally, it was an integrated high school, but they had a pattern of putting all black graduates in the back of the yearbook. Although we were pictured with our class, group pictured with our class throughout the yearbook during our sophomore and junior years. But in our senior years, they pulled all the black out with all the alphabetical order and put us in the back of the back. In the back. Well. So I decided that I would not put my picture in the back and started a movement of black graduates in that particular class. It wasn't that many of us. It was 13 out of a class of close to 250. But we were conspicuous by our absence. There was not a black picture in the graduating class that year. And that was my first effort to organize a protest. And we succeeded. And the very next year, the next graduating class, they stopped that business. And when war was over, I'll never forget it. I went back to Junction City in 1945, and the principal saw me walking down the street. I graduated in 43, I was back in 45, and he saw me walking down the street, and he pulled his car over and honked the horn and waved at me and jumped out and came and got me and says, have you got a moment? And I said, yes, Mr. Carnes. He says, well, get in the car. I want to take you by the school. I want to show you something. So when we get down to the school, he was just tickled. He was walking on clouds. Walked in, and he handed me the 1944 yearbook. And lo and behold, they had the pictures in the yearbook in the order that they should have been.
Oh,
and he
boy.
Was just beaming and saying, and he said that I'm going to credit you and Jim Warren. I was the first black in the state of Kansas to make an all-state high school football team. Hmm. And we had a... Even back then, we had a 1-2 punch. The fullback was black. His name was Jim Warren, and I was a tailback. I was single wing, and then I used to play in also on both offense and defense. So he said, you and Jim are responsible for us changing this policy. And I've been at it ever since, and I'm 68 now.
Okay, well, you got a good indoctrination and a good start. And we'd like to also know, when did you begin your term with the Civil Rights Commission?
Oh, I became the chairman of the commission in February 1990. I was appointed by President Bush at the time to a full term. Mine is a 6-year term. And I will be there until to November the 29th, I believe it is, 1995.
Mm. Okay. Could you tell our listeners what the commission actually does?
Yeah, well, the commission is the result of a tremendous protest that black Americans in particular had made. I should pause and say that... for most of this country's history, up until, in fact, the Civil Rights Act of 1957, which created the commission I now chair, although other ethnic and racial groups were being denied equality, they wouldn't complain about it for all intents and purposes. They said very little. The only group in the country that were vocal about discrimination were black Americans, which led to an assumption that the only group in the country that were denied their equal rights were black Americans. So when the commission was eventually brought into being by acts of Congress, its real thrust was to look at the denial of full citizenship for black Americans. Although Hispanics and Asians and Indians, Native Americans, were included in the legislation, the perception was that the only ones who really couldn't fit into the society were Black Americans. I might just add that the latest research still shows that the group that will be the last to be embraced by the rest of the population in the country are African Americans. That, and our research has already shown, showing that Asians will be embraced and find the welcome mat out long before Black Americans. Hispanics will be embraced and find the welcome mat out long before Black Americans. And so, I'm trying to make a point. That has led to the perception on the part of Blacks, ironically, I might add, and on the part of whites to a considerable degree, ironically, that the only ones denied full equality are Blacks. But our research shows that Hispanics are victimized by race and racism to a considerable degree, almost to the same level as Black Americans. Asians, we call them the so-called silent victims. They're only now beginning to speak up. But when we do studies on discrimination across the country, and particularly discrimination in the West, some of the research reveals that the brutality against Asians was just amazing. But here again, their culture was such that they said very little. They didn't believe then that the law would be fair and equitable. So their attitude was, we're not going to complain to them, because when we do complain, they're not going to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And that was back at the turn of the century and throughout most of this one. And there still is. When we go into areas of the country today, there are still huge numbers of Asians and considerable number of Hispanics who don't believe that complaining to the police or complaining to the official government body is going to do any good at all. And so they don't say if they're very quiet about it, and it's not in tune, in line with their culture to be vocal and aggressive. Found that to be the case in the world, in the recent wide. I call it Watts 2 in California. We found the Koreans and other elements from the Pacific Rim were very reluctant to try to make their case. Although they felt that they were truly victimized, and that the victimization had been going on a long, long time by the Los Angeles Police Department against them also. But they didn't say very too much about it. And so I guess I say all that to say that the role of the Civil Rights Commission is to do scientific research and investigations to find out, based on the statutes. We're controlled by the statutes. The statutes tell us what we can and can't do. And our job then is to go into communities to find out if those statutes are being enforced, if they're being carried out. That's our job.
Okay. Thank you for enlightening our listeners on the work of the Civil Rights Commission, which is very important and also much needed.
Let me say again now, because people get the two mixed up. The Civil Rights Commission and the EEOC, the Equal Opportunity Commission, are two different commissions.
Okay.
All right. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has enforcement powers.
Okay.
The Civil Rights Commission is an investigating arm only.
Mm-hmm.
We have no enforcement powers.
I see.
But what we do have the ability to do is use subpoenas to get the record to see how well an agency is implementing its civil rights obligation.
I see.
To make sure your audience is pretty clear on this, let's take equal housing opportunity. That's a responsibility of HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. When the bill was passed by the Congress, signed into law by the President, the prime interest agency, the agency responsible for equal housing, is HUD. Our job, the Civil Rights Commission's job, is to investigate and research to find out if HUD is implementing the fair housing legislation.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And to file reports with the president and the Congress based on our findings. And if our findings are such that HUD is doing a good job, we report it. If our findings are such that HUD is not doing a good job, we also report that. But we make recommendations. Our research is supposed to be such that we uncover the problem, and upon doing so, make recommendations to correct it, so that the Congress knows what should be done and so that the president knows what should be done.
I see.
All right.
Okay. Now, if a particular citizen had a problem, could they bring that problem where they felt that there was some type of unfair practice or discrimination?
Citizens can file complaints. If the question you're asking is can citizens file complaints with the Civil Rights Commission, the answer is yes.
Okay.
And what do we do with the complaint? If it's a complaint in housing, we turn it over to HUD.
Okay.
If it's a complaint in justice, we turned it over to the Attorney General and the Justice Department. Mm-hmm. If it's a complaint in equal employment opportunity, we turn it over to EEOC.
Oh, I see.
The Equal Opportunity Commission. Mm-hmm. If we get a large enough volume of complaints, then if we have the money in our budget, and of late we haven't had, but if we had the money in our budget, let's take New York. Well, I'll tell you what we did do. We began to monitor newspapers. You'd appreciate this. We started monitoring newspapers and reports of violence based on race for about a year, starting in 1990. And we saw a pattern right across the country, in which city after city and paper after paper, weekly papers, daily papers, and others were reporting acts of violence because of race. We took closer looks and found out a lot of it was on college campuses. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, we have what we call state advisory committees. We have a New York State Advisory Committee on Civil Rights. Those advisory committees also were monitoring violence because of race, animosities because of race that was getting into the papers throughout the states. So we saw a pattern from Maine to San Diego and from Anchorage to Miami and all points in between. So we wrote letters to the president and to the members of the House and the Senate suggesting that a summit on race relations be held in order to avoid what did happen in Los Angeles.
Oh,
We were on record as saying Los Angeles, there is a potential for this kind of thing to happen. And we asked the president by way of mail, and the speaker of the House, Congressman Foley, the minority leader of the House, Congressman Bob Michaels from Illinois, and Senator Mitchell, the majority leader of the Senate, and Bob Dole, the minority leader, and every governor. We wrote every governor in the country and said there is a potential for racial violence in your state. And we urge you, governors, to get together with the president and to hold a national summit and let the people across this country know that from a public policy point of view, the governors, regardless of party, the president, regardless of party, mayors, regardless of party, are all with one mind and one voice with respect to equality of opportunity and violence because of race. Bottom line, young man, is that we did not get the summit. Let me be fair. The South Carolina governor answered and said he thought it would be a good idea. One of the governors from the Dakotas said, we don't think it's a good idea and stay out of our state. We didn't hear from the rest. The other 48 didn't answer.
Okay.
And so we had the riot. I'm coming to something. We had the riot. And it sparked in several other cities. There is a chance that between now and May that the new members of the commission will once again write to the new president, to the Speaker of the House, minority and majority leaders, and to all the governors and say that this could happen again. Mm-hmm. And we're going to recommend that we hold the summit one more time. Only this time, I think that we would also recommend that state attorneys general and other law enforcement people at the state level also participate in a national summit designed to prevent what we still think is the prospects for a considerable amount of violence throughout the United States based on race. Now, there's a reason for that. And what we're hearing, again, as a research agent, we're hearing that Americans are arming themselves to the teeth, that guns are selling. And I got a report the other night from Alabama that they're actually, you can actually, like you buy a Big Mac through a drive-through window. Mm-hmm. I understand. I can't validate this. I'm going to try to find out if it's true. But I had some people call me from Alabama and say they're actually selling guns through drive-ins. Okay?
Yes.
Now, that's dangerous.
Yeah, it's not a good sign.
That's not a good sign at all. We do not want a Bosnia Herzegovina here in this country. But and I think the politicians can get it stopped. They're going to have to hold a summit of some kind to say that it will not be tolerated. And put everybody on notice that we're not going to allow our diversity and differences cause us to self-destruct. And that's what could easily happen unless we get serious about it.
True. Okay, once again, for those of you that might just be tuning in, this is Where You Live, WWHB 107.1. We're talking with Mr. Arthur Fletcher, the chairman of the United States Civil Rights Commission. He's giving us some very insightful information. And we thank you all for tuning in. Mr. Fletcher, how did the commission actually first come into existence?
Well, the commission is a product of the end of World War II, really. From the time of emancipation, and I'll go back again and say that there was this perception that the only real element in this country that would never be able to be fully embraced with blacks. They didn't think any other ethnic or racial group would have the problem. The assumption was once they get an education and some other things, they blend in and you'll never know that they're minority. All the education in the world won't blend the black in, particularly if he's truly a black. We have some light-skinned ones that can make it through and be anything but black. But if you're truly black, inside and out, particularly out, education doesn't render you acceptable to the degree that it will others. But anyway, they kept saying that discrimination against black Americans was anecdotal. That happens occasionally, hither, thither, and yon, but there's no pattern. And so at the end of World War II, the GI Bill of Rights, which was a bill that no one thought its outcome, one of its ultimate outcomes would be what it was. Right quick, at the during World War II, 12 million American men and women were inducted in, volunteered and or were inducted into the military. Close to 2.5 million black Americans went into the military.
Wow.
During the war, Congress passed a bill called the GI Bill of Rights. And that bill was waiting for the war to be over and for military troops to return home. The bill was colorblind. One of the few pieces of legislation that was truly colorblind. It said, if you fought for this country, to defend this country, color notwithstanding, you could go to school, you could buy a house, and a number of other things. Well, that was the first time that blacks in huge numbers could go to school. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm a product of that. I went to school under the GI Bill of Rights. I came home, discharged in 1945, in October 45, and in September 46, I enrolled in college. I had a wife and two children, and had a couple more before I finished college. But discharged in October 45, and in college in September 46. Close to 500,000 of us went to school under the GI Bill of Rights. And up to this point, the assumption had been that if a black person could get an education, he or she would be acceptable, socially acceptable, at all levels in the workplace, and thus they could move right on up. The education was the defining quality that you need. Well, lo and behold, it wasn't so. We got educated going and coming. mm-hmm. in every field you could think of. But we continued to be black. And lo and behold, we found that we had edgy out, that we had qualified ourselves beyond what we were welcome and or allowed to do at the workplace. So what you had then was blacks with degrees of every description you could think of, professional degrees, lawyers, doctors and others, who found the door just as closed as it was if they were only high school dropouts or otherwise. So that comes to the answer to your question. We battled to prove that was the case, and Congress finally said, well, there's one way we can find out. We'll create an agency that mission is to do nothing but research in the area of race. The commission was created in 1957 with one mandate, and that was to investigate the extent to which black Americans were being denied the right to vote. It also included Hispanics again and others. But once again, there was a reluctance on the part of the Hispanic and Asian communities to allow themselves to be included. It's only now, I might just add, that Asians and to an increasing degree Hispanics, after watching the progress that blacks had made because of a high level of political activity, have decided they better get organized and get to playing hardball politics along with the rest of us, mm-hmm. Along with black Americans. But that was the reason for creating the Civil Rights Commission, was to see if all these allegations would bear up under on a tight investigation structure, a scientific investigation structure. Well, of course, it proved out. Mm-hmm. It didn't take very long to say, no, that's a pattern right across the country. They've been denied the right to vote. They've been denied to buy a house, denied this, denied that. And it's a pattern. You can investigate it, and there it is. Mm-hmm. It jumps out at you. So that's how the commission came into being.
Okay.
Now, the reason for that is that's what leads to the legislation. Once you can prove the pattern, then you take the scientific finding, the investigation finding, and show that here's the pattern, and the way to correct, if it can be corrected by legislation, then there's a recommendation for legislation.
Okay.
This is important because there are a lot of conservatives out there, black and white. White folks have a tendency to think they're the only conservatives. We got black conservatives who will argue with us about the need for legislation, too. And what we say to them is that the legislation on the books isn't because of somebody's opinion. We've spent hundreds of thousands, and in some instances, millions of dollars to investigate, to prove that the pattern is there, and to prove that it's a product of race. Okay. So I want to emphasize this again, because many of my white friends think that black Americans are dying to get a law on the book. Not so. There's a significant number of black Americans who say, no, I don't want the law on the book. I don't believe you can prove that there's a pattern there. So we have to prove our case. My point is, young man, we have to prove our case to everybody.
Right.
And you have some white folk in your audience who think that we don't have to prove the case to black people, too. We have to prove the case to black people, too. And in fact, so we found in some of our research that black people don't even know when they've been discriminated against. Okay.
Yeah, so we got a lot of proof.
And when you lay the pattern out there and they see it, they say, oh, I didn't know. Well, I'll be doggone. God, I didn't know I was being discriminated against.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of folks like to think that it's an easy road to hold. There's nothing easy about it. We're watched under the watchful eye of activists who think we're not doing enough. Conservatives think we're doing too much. And moderates who could care less and don't want us to do nothing. So we have to make our case. When I say make our case, they come down to Congress to challenge us.
Mm-hmm.
And they come in with opinions and counter-opinions as to our finding. And if they find a flaw in our research design, then they challenge our findings.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say that again now. If that research design doesn't meet sound scientific research patterns, then all of our findings are questioned. and in fact thrown out. So it's not some loose thing that people would like to think that we're just out there making mischief and we don't live up to any particular level of standards. Quite the contrary. Our findings are challenged. Our research design is questioned. Our findings are challenged. And we have to be able to go before the Congress, the courts, or anyone else and hold our own based on what we not allege the facts to be, but what we found them to be, okay, as a result of our research.
Okay, so your research then has to be factually tight in order for you to even have a case to be considered, in other words.
That's right.
Okay.
You see, we asked, again, I don't want your audience to miss it. When we file a report with the Congress, we make recommendations for legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We make recommendations to change a regulation. Now, what does that mean? That means you change the machinery. And sometimes to change that machinery and redirect the thrust costs thousands, if not millions of dollars. Okay? And so when we go before the Congress, one of the first questions is asked is, what's it going to cost to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And is it worth it? Is the remedy worth it? What will the fallout be? If in fact we correct this, how will this improve the quality of life for minorities? And how will it enhance America's democracy and freedom? We have to make that case.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay? And the Congress wants to know, what did it cost you to do this? And if it's done right, what will the outcome be?
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay. We're in the middle of celebrating African American History Month. One of the things I'd like to know, does the commission itself sponsor any special events?
No. The commission doesn't. That's not our. We have what we call a legislative mandate. And there's nowhere in our mandate that says we can spend a dime of the taxpayers' dollars to hold a special event.
Okay.
All right. Make it very clear. We do investigation.
Okay.
We do fact finding. And those kinds of things to see if American citizens are being denied their civil rights.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the more memorable cases you've worked on yourself personally?
Well, I'm known as the father of affirmative action.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. Give us a little background.
Well, the background there was, when I say the father of affirmative action, I should add one caveat and say I'm known as the father of the enforcement movement in terms of affirmative action. We had affirmative action on the as a part of a regulation, but it was voluntary. And employers, and particularly union employers and other government contractors. And you should know that at that time, close to 60% of the nation's corporations did business with the federal government, contract of the federal, state, and particularly the federal government. And there was a civil rights mandate that said wherever taxpayers' dollars are spent, all citizens should have an equal opportunity to work there.
Mm-hmm.
Because all citizens pay taxes.
True indeed.
Okay, including Black Americans. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that those tax dollars come back into the economy by way of doing two things, creating jobs and contracting opportunities. Up until 1966, the chance, actually up until, yeah, 66 was fair. The chances of a minority or a woman or a Hispanic being able to get a contract to contract with the federal government was about like a elephant being able to give birth to a kangaroo.
Mm. Slim to none.
Absolutely none. Okay, and yet that's a clear violation of equity in terms of taxpayers. So when I became Assistant Secretary of Labor, there was a mandate on the books that said there shall be equal opportunity for minorities and women where government contracting is concerned. I emphasize again, government contracting is contracts that are underwritten with taxpayers' dollars.
Okay.
All right. And so when I became Assistant Secretary, it was up to me to find a way to enforce that mandate. And I enforced it with a document called the Revised Philadelphia Plan. The original Philadelphia Plan was a voluntary plan that said construction contractors in the Philadelphia area will be fair employment practice employers. The construction contractors said, we won't define, they said they should be fair employment practice employers, but and that they wouldn't discriminate. There was no definition of discrimination.
Okay.
And see, under our system of laws, you must define what you're trying to correct. And the civil rights legislation of 64, which said there shall be fair, equal employment opportunity and no discrimination against minorities and women, didn't define discrimination. Okay? So when I came along in 1969, I decided that in my mind of minds that a definition of discrimination would be the absence, not the inclusion, okay, but the absence of minorities and women at a given workplace on a given contract when their presence was significant in the labor market. Okay. Now, what are we saying? I'm saying that there's a legal standard called the reasonable man's doctrine. It would be reasonable to assume, barring any other information, it would be reasonable to assume that if 30% of the people in a given labor market are black, then barring any extraneous barrier, 30% should be working.
Okay.
Now, you start with that. That's called the prima facie case. You start with the prima facie case of discrimination, their absence. Now comes the reason for their absence. And there could be any number of legitimate, non-discriminatory reasons for their not being there. All right?
Mm-hmm.
But the burden then shifts to the employer to say that they're not here, but it's not because I'm discriminating. Well, when we first issued the Revised Philadelphia Plan in 1969, there was a pattern and practice of discrimination against minorities and women that was cultural. Since then, there's been considerable improvement. It's much harder to prove an individual case of discrimination today than it was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, we had a discriminatory culture. And it was just automatic. Women don't do that kind of work. For what give it? Well, because we just don't let women do that kind of work. Blacks don't do that kind of work. Why not? Well, we just don't want them to do that. With the enforcement of the civil rights legislation and affirmative action in 1969, it turned out that it was against the law to deny them the opportunity to do that simply because it was a cultural trait. So what we've been doing now, for your information, the last 30 years, we've been going through a revolutionary change in our culture. You can't deny women the right to an opportunity to become an engineer just because women haven't been engineers in the past. Or you can't deny a black an opportunity to become a stockbroker on New York on Wall Street simply because blacks didn't do that the first three quarters of this century. Now that they've been going to school, learning how to do it, and the supply is there, a company on Wall Street has to prove they're not discriminating when they end up with a lily white stock brokerage firm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's basically all it was about. Mm-hmm. And what we've been doing with affirmative action is encouraging persons like yourself, for an example, to go back to school and decide you want to work in the communication industry. It stands to reason now that with you and others like you going to communication school and qualifying yourselves to get into this industry, then it stands to reason that if you meet the standards, get your degree and various other things, and meet whatever standards that are operable, then the burden is on the radio station to explain why, with campuses loaded with blacks and women, taking communication. And then you go to a station that is lily white, all males. Then you say, wait a minute, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. So the burden then is on them,
right,
to prove that that they're not discriminating. We didn't say your absence there by itself means that they're discriminating, but they have to explain why you're not there. And that's called a good faith effort. If you ever heard that term, good faith effort, well, a good faith effort. How do you make a good faith effort? You get in touch, you're an employer, you get in touch with communication schools at universities across the country. And say, in the past, blacks and Hispanics haven't done this, but today we hire everybody that's qualified. Would you supply us with a list of the names of your students who are in communication schools, etc., and we'll be graduating. We want to interview them right along with everybody else. 40 years ago, we didn't do that. Okay. 30 years ago, we didn't do that. 20 years ago, we didn't. But today, we do. Okay. And as a result of doing that, and we happen to know that blacks and Hispanics and women are going to schools of communication. So the reasonable man's doctrine, I'll come back to it again. The reasonable man doctrine says that if you are going to, if there are tens of thousands of minorities and women going to communications school and qualifying themselves, the reasonable man's doctrine says they ought to be employed somewhere.
Right. Sure.
And since you're in the communication business with a radio station license, with a television station license, and with all them kids going to school to prepare to work at your station, the reasonable man doctrine suggested somewhere down the road you ought to be hiring some of them, they ought to be on your payroll, or you should be explaining to us why you're not.
Okay.
And since you have a federal, what you have is a piece of federal property, that license to be on the air is a federal statistic. And the federal government statute says there shall be equal employment opportunity where federal statutes and federal resources are concerned. That's what it's about.
Okay. All right.
That's
okay.
It.
All right. Thank you for clarifying that for our listeners. Excuse me.
Now, if it had been equality all along in the past, if we hadn't had this horribly flawed history of discrimination, then there'd be no need for affirmative action. Sure. There'd be no need for civil rights. But our history is such that we're trying to get over that flaw. When the founding fathers put the country together, there was a major flaw. And that is, they put together a document that they didn't intend to live up to. Let me say that again. They put together a constitution and a bill of rights that was private unto them only. They said everybody, but they didn't mean everybody. They meant themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even mean all white people. Mm-hmm. You know, our research shows that when Italians started coming over here in large numbers, they weren't welcome either. When Catholics started, I'm talking about back when the country first became, when the Catholics started coming over as a result of the potato famine, they were white. They were welcome. All right. So my point, the founding fathers didn't mean it. And we've been struggling trying to give meaning and life to those words and bring them to the point where they're meaningful, where they mean it. Okay.
All right.
If the founding father were to come back and find you sitting behind that radio and mic today doing what you're doing, he'd be shocked. That ain't what we had in mind. We put those pretty words on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
Liberty and justice and equality for all. But you were not included as a part of the all.
Right. Okay.
In fact, in the beginning, the all were only people who owned property.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't matter what color you were. Okay.
Okay.
And if they were to come back today and find people who don't own property voting, they say, wait a minute, that ain't what we, that's not what we put on a piece of paper.
I see. I wanted to find out from you, what is the significance of referring to African Americans as having been formerly enslaved as opposed to former slaves?
That's a good question, and I frankly don't get into semantics. I focus on what the Constitution says today and the legislation we have today. And I'm a contemporary activist. I'm interested in improving an environment where you can enhance your quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get caught up in semantics. I find that the right wing likes nothing better than to have us off debating in the corner whether we're Afro-Americans, African-Americans, black, and spending all that time and wasting all that energy. And when you get through proving which one you approve,
What has that done to enhance the quality of life you live? As far as I'm concerned, nothing. Now, I don't want to overstate the case. Yeah, there's some validity to it. But my lifespan is too short for me to worry about which one of those. When I'm sitting where I can improve your chances of getting a job, I'm not about to get off. Caught off. Okay. On a detour arguing about that when opportunities are emerging over here every day. I'm not going to do that.
Okay. I did have a specific reason for asking that particular question, having done some research myself on the, I think it was 1984, they started with the New York State Department of Education. They came out with some ideas that they wanted to formulate into new legislation dealing with the curriculum of inclusion.
Okay. Yeah.
Which was basically they wanted to kind of change the way history was portrayed about including all peoples having been positive contributors to history and not just some cultures being the dominant contributors to history.
Yeah, well, I hear what you're saying, of course. Now, that certainly makes some sense, and I personally am concerned that history be from here on in written in a way that it reflects the contribution of all Americans. Now, you're going to have your right-wing element screaming bloody murder. They're trying to rewrite history, and that isn't the way it is. And, of course, the more we dig into the archives, the more we're finding out that hordes of people were left out.
True indeed.
You know, I'll come back to my own father and his regiment, the Buffalo Soldiers, the 9th and 10th Cavalry. They're beginning now to go into the archives at the West Point and various other places. I mean West Point, but yeah, even West Point. And down at the Pentagon. And now they're beginning to tell the story of the 9th and 10th Cavalry being played major roles in opening up the West. They were the ones carried the wagon trains over the Oregon trails to Oregon. But up until very recently, the impression was only the 2nd Cavalry, which was white, and the 8th Cavalry, which was white, did that, and the 9th and 10th had nothing to do with it. And the only way we could find out up until very recently the role that the 9th and 10th played was to go on Indian reservations in Montana and Idaho and talk to some of the Indians through their old history, and they began to tell the story of the role that the 9th and 10th Cavalry played and the fear that the Indians had of those two regiments as opposed to the 8th and 10th. And now we're going back into the archives, and lo and behold, all that information that the Army had it all the time, the Pentagon had it all the time, they're finally opening it up, and we're beginning to hear about it. So yeah, that needs to be correct. Let me just give you one other, because I think it's so important. This month's been a very interesting month in terms of Black history. And earlier this month, there was public broadcast, right, television, and it showed the Tuskegee Airmen, and it talked about the manner in which they protected bombers, and they talked about bombing raids. And they called the Tuskegee Airmen, who weren't supposed to be able to fly airplanes, incidentally. The attitude was there's no way Blacks might be able to work on an airplane, but they can't fly one. And if they can fly one, they can't fly a fighter pilot because they're too scared. Well, it turns out that the 92nd, not the 92nd, but the Tuskegee Airmen, never on one of the largest bombing raids in World War II. I forget how many bombers were in there, but it was a significant number. They didn't lose a bomber.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
And what was interesting is there was this one bombing raid that was shown. There was a pilot who flew a bomber. And he said 5 MiGs were after him. What was that German? Spitfire, I guess. The German Spitfire. I believe that was the name of their fighter plane. But it was a good fighter plane. And he said he just knew. He and his crew knew with these 5 planes coming at him, they weren't going to make it. And
and the Red Tails. They call that black airman outfit, fighter outfit, they call them the Red Tails. Whenever they knock a plane out, they wiggle their tail, and they call them the Red Tail. Whenever they saw a tail wigging, they knocked the German plane out. This guy called. He called the station to say that he was on that bombing raid. And he knew, this was a white pilot flying the bomber, said he knew his days were over. And they knocked out all five of those mags. So he said, if there's anybody in the Red Tails listening tonight, I was on the bombing raid, and I want to thank you. You saved their lives.
Wow, that's a great piece of
what's very
black
interesting
history right there.
Is lo and behold, until this month, nobody knew how I knew they were good. I knew it was I knew they were an effective fighter squad. I had no idea they were that good. And lo and behold, this was just a week or so ago. I think it was the first week of Black History.
We'd like to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. And before we go, we'd like to just give us a little information about the University of Denver's International Institute for Corporate Social Policy, which I know you're heavily involved in.
Well, I've been asked to come and create it, really. We have a business school there. University of Denver, very outstanding business school. It ranks number 3 among business schools putting out accountants. Our accounting division, one of the best in the country. The business school decided that issues like corporate social policy shouldn't be taught over in the school. Social policy shouldn't be taught over in the social work school. To the degree that it impacts a corporation, it should be in the business school. So I've been asked to come and create an institute that would make, as a part of the business curriculum, right along with all the other business technology, a part of the management curriculum, is how to manage a child development center at the workplace by a corporation. How to manage the environmental protection program as a part of business mission. How to manage an affirmative action program as a part of the business mission. How to manage a minority and women business set-aside contracting opportunity program as a part of the business school mission. Now, normally, those are all looked upon as social missions, and you put them anywhere and everywhere, but don't put them in the business school. Well, the University of Denver said, no, it belongs in the business school. So they hired me to come out and create the institute and design the curriculum, and begin to teach all of these things that heretofore have been considered social programs as a part of the business school's business mission.
I see. Okay. All right, well, we're just about going to wrap up here. Once again, for those of you that have been listening, this is Silas Kelly with this special edition of Where You Live in honor of Black History Month. We've just been talking with Mr. Arthur Fletcher, the United States Commission of Civil Rights Chairman, and we thank Mr. Fletcher for all his time and his wealth of knowledge that he's given to us, especially all the enlightening things. And we'd like to wish all of you out there a very good rest of Black History Month, and we hope you all learn something and share some culture and some knowledge with others that you might run into. And the more we learn about each other, the more we can begin to come together as people. So once again, we'd like to thank you for joining us this morning, and have a nice day.
Once again, this is Silas, your e-journalism social work advocate, producer, and host of the show. You've been listening to the award-winning Kelson on the Air social work podcast. This and all other episodes are available on our Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon Music, Audible, and iHeart audio podcast platforms, among others. The podcast is also available on our Spotify and YouTube video podcast platforms. Go to any search engine and type in Kelson on the Air in the search window to hear this show in its entirety. Please make sure to click subscribe to support our podcast. And don't forget to like, comment, download, and share. To reach us for more information, email us at info@kelson.org. That's info@kelson.org. Or to suggest future topics, log into www.kelson.org. That's www.kelson.org, and fill out the share a topic form on our homepage. Thank you for tuning in. This has been a Kelsun Communications production.